Welcome to Planning Commission meeting for the City of Cedar Hills, Utah, dated Tuesday, August 23rd, 2016. The first order of business is called order, which I just did. Is there any public comment?
Open mic, Dan.
There's nobody here for a public comment, so I will close that portion of the meeting. Scheduled items, number three. Approval of minutes from the June 28th, 2016 Planning Commission meeting.
I move we approve the minutes from the June 28th, 2016 Planning Commission meeting.
Do I have a second?
I'll second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All right. Number four is review action on Lakeshore Trails PUD subdivision fencing.
So many of you were on the Planning Commission, I think all of you were on the Planning Commission when we approved Lakeshore Trails down there on Canyon Road next to the city building. You can see that the work's being done, there's moving along. One of the things that they're wanting to do is to put in a wall fence sound barrier on that side adjacent to Canyon Road. And as per City Code 10518G in the fence code, any PUD, planned unit development, which this is, requires that any fence be approved by the Planning Commission and the City Council. So what you have two handouts here. One is the plat, and you can see the purple line where, is it purple? Is it color for you guys, or is it black?
Yeah, it's
I guess it depends on how it printed out for you. But the purple line indicates where the fence will be on the subdivision. And the second page would be a sample profile of what it would look like as one were walking by. So you see that from the lip of the curb and the sidewalk, there's 5 feet plus another 5 to 7 feet of riprap, which is just small rock, about the size of a fist, a little bit bigger than your fist, followed by a landscaping wall, which has been installed there, and that landscaping wall is to be under 40 inches, whereupon it is considered a landscape wall, not an engineered retaining wall. And then the concrete fence would be placed 15 feet away from that top back of a curb. And that concrete fence would be 6 feet typical on along the road there. However, in clear view areas or where it turns into it, you can see where the fence kind of bends into the subdivision. Those points would be 3 feet to maintain some open vision areas. On that, from the property line, that green line on the diagram, the property line sits about 5 feet from the back of the sidewalk. Fence would stay in the middle of a public utility easement, which shouldn't be a problem because the city doesn't currently have any utilities there. The city has a wide berth along Canyon Road to lay utilities if they needed to. The only requirements that the city would ask of the developer would be that the fence not exceed 6 feet in height, the fence and the landscaping wall to remain at least 3 feet from any power pole, and that's per Rocky Mountain Power standards. Access to manholes are to be approved by the city engineer and the building inspector, and they've been out there on site and looked at what he's already done, and I think that we've made changes and they look good. The landscaping wall needs to remain less than 40 inches in height, and the slope of the project needs to not exceed 3:1. That's our standard fill ratio. So, with that being said, are there any questions from the Planning Commission?
Is there anything for weed abatement or anything under the riprap?
Yeah, there is. They laid down the weed barrier. At least I saw them do that. Did they do it the whole length? I saw them do that.
And all the riprap and stone walls already in?
Yeah. So the fencing, it's really the fence that's being approved tonight, the location of the fence.
This doesn't require.
The fence goes in front of the retaining wall I viewed on my way here or at on.
Say that again.
When I was driving here, I noticed there was along Canyon Road, there was the riprap, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Was it on top?
It's on top of the retaining wall, landscape wall.
Okay.
It's on top and maybe a foot and a half, 2 feet back. It's just okay. A little bit offset there. Go ahead.
There is an existing fence there that you're mimicking, and that's the Questar fence. They're on the north side of our entryway, so the plan from the beginning was to have a fence all along Canyon Road. And Questar, when we sold that property to Questar, we did it with the caveat that they put in that concrete fence, which they already had a concrete fence in front of their substation. So it continued all the way to our entryway. So this has been the plan all along, to have a fence along Canyon Road, and that was like phase one. And we started phase two, went for the permit, blah, 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 found out that the fence couldn't be at the property line, so I moved it planned to move it 5 feet back, and then found out it couldn't even be 5 feet back. It had to be even further back, and that's when David and Chandler said, let's push for an exception. So it's a location exception, not...
Yeah. So this is, if you look at your plat map, all the properties that are affected are side yards. This would be the side fence for them. And if you look at the side yard setback, or the side yard, the side yard setback in the code, it does require 15 feet from the top back of curb, and that's why we're requiring them to have 15 feet there. It does place the fence in the public utility easement, which, like I said, shouldn't be a problem since the city does not have any utilities, and we have a 60-foot wide or an 80-foot wide public right-of-way there where we can access utilities for future use.
The other exception you're seeking is a concrete fence.
No, that's not an exception. That's just part of the approval. So,
fences don't delineate.
Yeah, we're not delineating between the type of fence. Any time you could put a wood fence there, and you'd still need your approval.
Well, so I was trying to educate myself on fences. It's been a while, right? So I was just reading the fencing code, and I see that you can have three different colors of vinyl or wrought iron fence in the code. But I don't see where you can have a wood fence or a concrete fence.
You can have them.
But where is it in the code? Help me understand.
Just because it's not specifically outlined doesn't mean it's prohibited.
Well, there are certain places where you can't have.
Yeah.
There are certain places where you can only have certain types of fence, but that's limited areas. Like on the other side of the road from where they are, it's a concrete fence.
Yeah. And Questar, the reason that they're not part of this approval is that they're not part of the PUD. That's why they didn't need to come to this body to ask for their concrete fence. The concrete fence that Questar put in, I think, looks nice. They did a good job. They're going to match the same type of style, is my understanding.
Is this going to look? We're going to change the color a little bit. They messed up on the color.
Is theirs going to change as well?
And the Questar fence.
Yeah, we're going to change theirs.
That was the other question. What's the color of the fence going to be?
Questar.
I don't know. What is it?
It's similar to this, like there, but it has some orange. It has some spots of orange, and we don't like that. So we're going to change it to match our riprap. So it's similar to that color of that stone there.
So, if I hear you right, you're going to match, you've said this, you're going to match the fence style that Questar used versus the plank system across the street.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. We feel like we're going the extra mile to make this look good, functionally good for us. I mean, the code is even vague as far as I can see on who was responsible to put in the landscape strip there. We put in, the reed barrier and the riprap, trying to make it look good.
Yeah, it does look good.
Questar did not want to do what they did. We required them when we sold them the land.
Yeah.
Is the reason why, getting back to David's question, is the reason why we're not talking about open versus closed fence and type fence because this part of Canyon Road is not on the trail?
Correct.
Okay. That's what I thought.
And even then, if it were a trail, this planning commission, still there's code that allows for the planning commission to put a closed fence when the park trail is adjacent to a major street corridor. Mm-hmm. That still needs planning commission approval, but that's not this situation.
Mm-hmm. I have entertained a motion of any kind.
Take a stab at it. I move that we approve the proposed fencing along Lakeshore Trail subdivision, subject
to the conditions as shown in the attached drawing.
You want to possibly read in your motion the comments here?
Okay, that's part of the drawing, but we will say that the fence shall not exceed 6 feet in height. Fence will remain a minimum of 3 feet from any power pole. Access to manholes be approved by the city engineer and building official. The landscaping wall will remain less than 40 inches in height, and the slope of the finished area not to exceed 3:1.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? All right.
Chandler, can I add one thing? The comment was made about the space between curb and gutter and the fence. That, if I remember correctly, is the responsibility of the property owner and the person who puts the fence in. Is it not?
It will be at this point, but I'm sure that the weed abatement portion will end up being on the city at some point, because there's not an HOA to maintain it. I imagine it'll be a part of our weed spray program. A lot of these areas just kind of get neglected. So.
Is it going to be natural vegetation?
No, it's going to be riprap rock. They've laid down a fabric and put rock on top of it. So there's been efforts to try to prevent weed growth, but over time they will pop up. So I'm sure that during the summer the public works kids will go out and maintain it to some degree. It won't look immaculate, but it will. We'll try to maintain it. So the city's always looking at areas, and I work on the Parks and Trails Committee, and they're always looking at areas like this that they can try to work on and help. So across the street, there's a bit of a gap between the sidewalk and the fence, and that's been on their radar to make it look a little nicer over there. So these kind of things are on the city's radar.
So the next item on the agenda is discussion on renewable energy systems, solar panels.
All right, so the city gets a number of applications for solar permits throughout the year. I forget how many it was. I had it in the city council memo, and I don't have that. I didn't put that number in here, but it is quite a few. And typically they're for solar panels that are installed on rooftops, and they're very straightforward. Building code outlines how they're going to go. The code that we have here even goes so far as to regulate some of the renewable energy systems that people want to put just on the land, on their ground, in their backyard. Those aren't common, but I've gotten a number of questions from people, some wanting to go off the grid. I don't really understand what that means, but they want to...
explain that a few years ago.
Well, you can go off the grid on power, but you're still going to be tied to the city's well, the city's sewer. I mean,
yeah,
totally off the grid. But I understand where they're going. But they want to mount solar panels in their backyard. Now the city does not have any code related to how we regulate this. How do we limit it? So you can see that the code that's been proposed. This isn't even being proposed. This is just a discussion item tonight. So this is West Jordan's code, and I went through and looked at a lot of cities' code, and I believe this is the best code that I found. Most didn't have any, but West Jordan I felt like had something that was workable. One of the things that they had was it is a conditional use permit, and I would say that should be approved by the building official based on code. They also have wind turbines. You don't see those very commonly, but there is one in my neighborhood, for instance.
There's one over here.
That's actually in Highland.
Is that in Highland?
It's down there.
On the golf course, yeah.
Yeah, that's in Highland. That's not in Cedar Hills. We had the same conversation about that windmill when I brought it up. But I don't know of any in Cedar Hills. That's not to say that they will never be proposed, but it does go into basically the regulations limit the or try to mitigate the impact that it would have on surrounding neighborhoods, such as tower height, setback, the access. If it's a solar panel, minimizing the amount of reflected sunlight. One thing that we want to do is make sure that people still have a backyard, that they're not turning their backyard into a complete solar farm. So these are the kind of things that we're looking at. I hope you had the chance to read this. Give me some suggestions as we move forward, if any,
Can I ask
as we start drafting code. Yeah.
So you started out by saying you get a number of applications each year to install solar panels, right?
Yeah.
So under what basis or the code would somebody even come to you to even apply to do that, since there's
building
code.
Code
about it?
It's based on 100% building code. So right now, the building department will get an application for a building permit for solar panels to be put on the home.
It's like adding a deck.
It's like adding, it's not even like that, like a deck. A deck, I would see the application and I would approve a site.
There's no requirement they do so, right?
Say that again.
There's no requirement they come to the city
get a building permit. Yes, there is.
Yeah, there is.
It's a requirement.
You've got to have an electrician install it.
Let me understand where though, because you said a moment ago there's nothing in the code about solar panels, but now we're saying there is.
But it is a building issue. You're altering your building. And there's the solar panels. The solar panels. There's building code that affects how a solar panel is installed and where it can be on the roof and how many it can be there. And we want to see engineered snow loads. We want to see
that's
that
all there's national building code.
That's all in the international building code for 2012 is what the city currently has adopted. So they need to make sure that what they're installing is following building code. It does require a building permit. But when they get that permit, it's only subject to building code. Now, when we get a permit that says, from a gentleman that says, I want to put solar panels all over my yard, we don't have anything that says...
Freestanding
solar panels all over my yard. We have nothing that says you can't do anything. So that's where we're saying, okay, well, maybe this is something we need to look at.
I'm raising that if we implement this code, we might want to add language to that effect that they need to come get...
Yeah.
An application. So right now, if I was just to come to our code and I wanted to put solar on my roof and I went to the code and to see if I have to get the city's permission to do that or not, I'd go in there and, there's nothing here about solar, I'll just go
Well, down. But this, our city code refers to the International Building Code and there's yeah. And that, it's covered under that.
But yeah, but now you have an international building code expert, right, to know whether or not you do.
You really do. But when it does fall back on, well, this is a building code issue, and they say, well, where is that in the city code? We do always point to in city code, right. We have adopted IBC 2012.
So one suggestion is we would add that language that they would have to come get, apply.
Okay.
Otherwise, just presume that
I think that's... Okay.
I have a question on if the lots are smaller and they're in, for some reason they want to do it in their backyard, do we need to state, you cannot have it take up more than this percentage of your backyard?
That's what it would be. So when in the case of like a deck, let's say somebody had a small backyard but they wanted to put a deck in, right. we would still ensure that they have 50% of their yard in place. So it's not like a square footage, it's based on a percentage of their yard.
But with a deck, that's you can vary it that and that's easier than saying, well, I would need this amount of solar panels to make it worth my while to mm-hmm. have enough energy produced. Mm-hmm. So I could see them saying, well, we can't apply the same reasoning to how many solar panels. I'll need 27 solar panels, but that would take up more this. So we need to just make sure that it's there. If they say that they need more solar panels than they actually want them to allow to have, then what do we do?
Is that something that we want, though?
Yeah, no, see, I don't think it's this body's responsibility to determine if it's economically viable for them to have solar panels.
No, if they would, we wouldn't determine. But if they came back and said, "Well, you're saying that I can only put up, 50%. That's not going to produce enough energy."
Okay,
I'm just saying we just need to
on the roof.
So. I don't know. There's this house on the, if you take that road in Lehigh with the big giant dip, like you're headed to Costco.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And there's this
right the side
big freestanding.
All around it. There's
it's in the front yard and it's huge. It's not attached to the house. And my wife and I, every time we say, I'm all supportive of renewable energy, but we talk about how upset we would be if our neighbor put that in the front yard. We think it's very unsightly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now it's a, kind of a regular side front yard that's facing a kind of a thoroughfare. It's not, an acre lot or anything, but stuff like that I'm opposed to. I don't like that in the front yard. I think it's does not fit well with our community.
Yeah, I think based on what I like in the code, in West Jordan's code, it's the mitigating the negative impacts on the surrounding area. And I think I said that a little bit before, but it does say something when we would prohibit that in the front yard. We don't want that in the front yard. At least I don't suppose that that would be something that this body would want. But there's got to be some limit to what they can do there. So
it says here that their setbacks are the same as the building setbacks. So reasonably, you can't put anything in the front yard or side yard.
Yeah.
Based on what they have here.
Well, I would go so far as just to prohibit them in the front yard, just because some building lots, if you have a deep building lot and the house is built set back further than necessary, then that leaves some building envelope that they could put them in. I think this is something that would be fine in the side and the rear yard setbacks. I'm not opposed to any sort of renewable energy. I just think it should be
responsible. What about the front roof elevation, right?
Front roof, that's up to them. We have that, and if that's one of those homes that faces that way, it's up to them. But I think there's, in my mind at least, there's a big difference between somebody having it on their yard and on their roof.
Uh-huh. So. Can I ask a couple questions?
Yeah.
Number one, I think HOA rules, if they're more stringent, would apply to these items, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They can be more stringent than city code.
So as long as they're more stringent, whatever we decide to do and suggest to the council isn't going to override or diminish how strict HOA rules may be. And we have a number of communities that are governed by that.
But I think about their CC&Rs, I can't think of a single instance where they're prohibited. I would say that in most instances, the proposal of putting the solar panels in your yard would go to an architectural review committee.
When they're submitted. I'm suggesting in many instances that they're just put on. We have a number of homes, and as an architect, I drive by some of these houses, and it's, have a little house with your solar panel. It's welcome to our solar panel and our garage door. That's about all you seem to see on some of these, or whoever's making out like a bandit. But I wonder, do we have the ability to restrict some of this? For instance, I was online today looking at roof-mounted wind power. It looks horrible. I mean, it's these small windmills and I just can't imagine. It looks like a bunch of radio antennas and masts mounted to the ridge line on a number of these homes. Is that something that we step forward and say, we don't want to see that? If you're going to do wind power, it's only on the ground. If you're going to do solar, it's only on the roof, never on the ground.
I think you could go that far. I would, before passing any code like that, I would definitely run it through a legal review, making sure our attorney saw it.
Right. And I'm asking the question.
I don't see why not. I mean, cities can be restrictive in their zoning ordinances. That's a power given to the city by state code.
But if you can...
How restrictive is up to the city?
But if you can mitigate the impacts to adjacent property owners...
Yeah.
Like in West Jordan's code says, setbacks for ground-mounted solar energy systems shall be in the same as accessory structures found in subsection whatever of this chapter and are prohibited within the front yard area.
Okay, so let's say we pass that code. Accessory structures can be built within 5 feet of a property line.
Right.
And in my neighborhood, we've got so many corner homes where from a zoning standpoint, the front yard, it's really a technicality so that they can... build all the way around the corner, and essentially they've got, for all intents and purposes, they've got two front yards.
Yes.
So is there perhaps it's permitted in side yards with the following caveats, if that side yard faces onto a...
Not on street side yards or...
Something like that.
Or obstructed from view.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I don't want to be overly restrictive because, as was said earlier, I think this type of renewable energy is wonderful, and I'd love to see it make itself present in our community. I just, even from an aesthetic standpoint, I want to take a look at what we're going to end up with.
Well, if my neighbor wants to do something in his backyard, and it's not impacting me or the neighbors, then I think it's our business to stay out. But
yeah.
once it begins to impact neighbors, that's the whole point of government.
I think the unsightliness impacts property values, which impacts neighbors. That's probably the only impact there probably is.
Chandler, no, I that bark dog that barks every morning.
I look out my bedroom window and it's right there.
Photovoltaic
because we're
systems,
have 20 feet.
We're not talking about solar water heating or solar heat collecting or any of these other things, which if you watch it could kind of fall into the same category. So just
different animal than solar panels.
We're talking about electricity producing, solar panels. And
right.
Is that called out anywhere? Because, I mean, if you drive up to Bear Lake, you see, like, solar water heater systems and all kinds of things. People make all kinds of things, too.
And moment full disclosure, I mean, you walk up to the city's water tanks, and there's, things up on the tank that measure the water levels that do that kind of stuff, and they're powered by a ground-mounted solar unit. So... Mm-hmm. Maybe it's hypocritical of the city to say we don't want these.
That's a public facility zone, though, right?
It is a public facility zone.
There you go.
Yeah.
You're not in a residential zone.
A comment to that. How are the heat collecting units different from these?
Well,
I mean, I'm an engineer. I know how they're different. What I'm saying is from an unsightliness point of view.
From an aesthetic point of view.
Maybe it's not unsightliness.
I don't see there's a difference.
But some of the solar collecting units, and although probably a residential level one wouldn't do this, but, they're hazardous. There's heat, and there's all these kinds of things, and they kill birds, and, that happens. It's not you're probably not going to hit that with a, residential roof-mounted turbine or solar panels, but if somebody had like a collector tower or a Stirling motor or whatever, in their backyard, there is a hazard to that too. So
absolutely. So my point being, anything that we put in here should absolutely restrict those as well.
West Jordan's code does protect birds, I believe.
It has comments.
It has something.
Minimizing the impact.
There's environmental review stuff in there.
Right.
Yeah.
But one thing to consider is this is why I would prefer that this be a conditional use, because I don't think each lot is the same and can be treated the same. You look at Jeff's neighborhood, there's some unique circumstances attached to some lots. And I think if the city were to say, okay, this is a free-for-all, everyone can do whatever they want, then you end up with some bad results. But if it's a conditional use permit and they apply for the conditional use and the city can say, look, we can foresee a lot of negative impacts on the surrounding neighbors. So based on this criteria, and it would have to be based on certain criteria that's outlined in code, the city could say either limit your solar production or limit your wind production, or you can't do this at all, this isn't going to work. But the city would have to have some basis in code to say no, and that's why it would need to be a conditional use permit.
So there was also a comment earlier about the amount that somebody is producing, and I guess I should probably say I work for the power company, so my view may be a little skewed here. But people that are producing more power than they need and trying to put it back on the grid, those kinds of things, it's more of a business operation than it is a self-reliance thing. Those kinds of things might be considered as well. Like, are we going to allow people to export more than they need for their load for their house?
The law right now says they can't get any money for that. They can make more than their house uses, but they may not get more money. They can't get money back from the power.
Right. Yeah, I mean, net metering only covers up to what you would normally use.
Exactly.
And net metering may change.
You felt like you were altruistic to the power company.
So did.
No, I'm just, people have interesting ideas about this stuff. And if not addressed, sometimes they try to do very strange things.
Well, I like in West Jordan's codes to call it solar energy systems. That covers hot water. Covers photovoltaics.
I think theirs would cover the whole spectrum.
The evacuated solar tubes. All of it's covered under that.
I don't know that I've ever received a permit or an application.
There's
for
some older
other
houses.
Than electricity.
There's some older houses in town that have solar hot water systems.
Okay.
It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just different.
No. Well, it's not bad at all.
Does it need to be treated different?
You want to set a different spot.
I guess that's the question this body needs to decide.
It's a plumber versus an electrician putting it in. And that's the only difference.
Oh, I'm okay.
You're not connecting back to the grid.
Full disclosure, we use a solar hot water heater for the electron swimming pool for 10 years. And, it was 4 feet by 20 feet in the backyard mounted on, posts on the end of the ground. And very effective.
Speaking of solar program.
But for that unit, because it was seasonal and we took it down, we didn't apply for a building permit for it. I don't know if it's not there any longer. It no longer exists. But it's interesting because somebody else may want to do such a thing.
Yeah. There's
that something that would be.
There's merit. I'm not opposed to ground mounted solar. I'm not. Wind mounted solar or roof mounted wind turbines sound like a pretty awful idea. But
I was getting.
I don't. I've never. Just based on what I'm picturing in my head, it sounds like.
Actually, I took some time to look up some information on that during the meeting, and some of them look really bad, but some of them actually look fairly nice.
Okay, all right.
And they're, well, you know, with a lot of the homes we have today, they'd be up out of the way, and you wouldn't see them too much.
Do they generate noise?
Yes.
They're these
see,
ones.
Because that would be a negative impact on it.
They are at least sold as low power, low wind amounts, low noise, as compared to a larger turbine, which often emits louder noise.
There are silent. I mean, some of the vertical ones don't make any noise.
Okay. I mean that would be obviously something in consideration for any permit. Solar doesn't make any noise. Wind would be somewhat more noisy.
We had a neighbor who had a tower-mounted, classic-style, propeller-style turbine in Michigan, and it was truly annoying.
Because the noise?
The noise. I didn't care a bit about, you know, it wasn't killing birds that we saw. It was in his yard. I don't know, maybe it did. And it killed all the squirrels it wanted, but the noise.
What about the flicker? Did it ever affect you?
Flicker was never a problem. There were trees around, okay. And it was.
I'd like to start drafting some code to bring back to this body next month. And I've been given. I think there's a lot of direction. If I can just pin down ground-mounted solar, yay or nay? Which direction are you kind of leaning? Which way?
I'm fine with that, as long as it's obstructed or it's the conditional use, I guess.
Okay. I would just say in backyard areas that are surrounded by a fence.
It has to be fenced.
Well,
I would say that
in the obscured or
hillside. If you put your hand on a solar panel, it burns. They're hot. And so if kids are wandering around grabbing solar panels hanging out in somebody's yard, that's a hazard. So if you have them and they're ground mounted, they need to be protected from somebody walking up to them and grabbing them.
I'm not turning away from you. The sun's right there.
I should show a few more. Sorry.
I'm 6'5", so I can do it. But,
yeah. Okay. What about wind mount or roof mounted wind turbines?
I don't like it myself.
No.
But
I have what the property you're talking right about their side.
So what if there is a design that is. Totally.
I mean, there are the spiral that are different.
I mean, do you just put in the code that it must be silent, that it shall be silent?
Nothing's silent. I mean, you'd have to give it a decibel level or something.
What's the code for satellite dishes on roofs?
There's code for satellite dishes?
Is that behind?
No.
Anywhere goes?
You can go above your ridgeline of your roof about 10 feet with like a chimney or unoccupied space.
Right.
So, I mean, in some of these houses, you will see, I don't know that anyone's ever done that, but you will see like Vivint wireless antennas that they'll be projecting off.
Right.
And sometimes they can be unsightly, but I don't get complaints about them.
Well, I have.
But they don't make noise either.
Yeah. I have an inoperable system. Old wireless dish that's flying. It's been there long. 24 consecutive months. It's been inoperable for 7 years. Well, it's still there.
The other thing that you know, I mean, what parts of Cedar Hills get enough wind to make wind turbines viable?
Well, I live right on the mountainside. I get down dressed about every night.
The only time I get wind is if there's a storm coming. So I mean,
down lower a little bit. There's now hardly any wind, like even comparatively.
I know that some of the people even that live out on the mouth of the canyon along the creek have turbines. There have been turbines over the years, and there's only one left. So
how many people are using them, Chandler? Do you know
in the city?
Yeah,
I don't know of any wind turbines in the city.
You have to write the code on the presumption that the technology will change.
Yeah.
And they'll become more effective.
So then let me ask you this. Do you require, let's say that there are roof-mounted wind turbines, and you're okay with that as long as they don't exceed a certain decibel level?
Or a height.
Or a height.
Above there's a ridge.
But I guess my point is, do you have to go get a sound study in each case?
Well, the manufacturer is going to provide information on that.
Okay.
Yeah. What is the discussion, right? So. He asked a question like, what do you guys think of that?
Well, do you set a decibel level?
Who's in favor of a top-mounted one and who's not? Just
Just in favor of what?
Straw pole.
Roof-mounted wind. Anybody in favor of having roof-mounted wind turbines? Anybody on the group?
Well, I'm not in favor of it. But I'm just, but I mean,
nobody
would. Oh, I just say, well, what
should we prohibit it? Is the
should we prohibit it? When we, I mean, I'm not up on the technology. I mean, I've worked on the big turbines a lot, but I've never dealt with the small residential turbines, so I don't know anything about it. I wouldn't want a big commercial turbine. By
I'll do some research into it.
But
would we still allow a pole mounted turbine in the backyard, or would that be also excluded?
Well, I think it's
a wind turbine.
If we're using this as a guideline to start from.
Sure.
Yeah, they're allowing 40 feet.
Yeah.
That's a little tall.
That's huge. Really
so that's what I'm saying. They're allowing to 40 feet at the top of the
at least a half
blade.
Acre, 3/4 acres, 1 acre.
And they're saying minimal impact for sound.
Yeah, but
again, I hate the phrase minimal impact for sound. What does that mean? I think you're going to have to call it a decibel level or something.
I mean, the big ones are quiet. They're moving slow enough that they're quiet, but the little ones, they're moving
standing,
fast.
When you're standing by a big one, you can hear them.
Oh, you can hear them, but if you're across the field from them, you can't, But like the little ones sound like the propeller off a Cessna. I mean, they're going so fast to generate.
That was my experience with the small ones. But
the little blade ones, but they've got the vertical.
Yeah. And I'm not familiar
with the vertical blades.
Yeah. It seems like we want maybe a little more detail in the code to help govern this. And if you could do a little research on how some of the other smaller communities are regulating this.
I honestly don't know that any smaller communities are.
Well, if you look at the wind, I mean, they have wind maps that show you where solar, where wind is viable and stuff. And I just, we're so far out of a good.
We're not on the map.
We're so far out of a good area.
It's windy here all the time. I mean, you ever played soccer with your kids?
Unless the technology changes, right?
My uncle put up two turbines outside Rexburg, Idaho, where he lived, which is windy all the time. And after a year, he took them down and sold them because they weren't producing enough power to justify it.
I don't think they produce enough, though. It's just me.
But that was, 5-6 years ago, and the technology is always changing.
Yeah.
I was reading about turbines that will make power 5 miles an hour now. Today, so
five.
They're like mini turbines.
So Chandler, section E, abandonment. Just a couple of comments there.
Section E
in the example.
USB C.
Yeah.
Okay.
Abandonment.
All right.
24 months seems pretty long in my mind. Maybe 12 months, 18 months.
It says removed promptly.
And then promptly, what does promptly mean? I think that should be defined.
Is that within 30 days? Or?
And then
one of the notes I had in this, as with any adopting any new code, there needs to be definitions adopted as well. Right. So we'd probably have to go through this and make sure that we're adopting the
and
corresponding
definitions.
And Part
B says the owner is responsible. Some of these systems, the homeowner doesn't own the system. Just to be clear, it should be the homeowner is responsible.
And I think item 3 in that same general provision covers what Stephen was worried about. It says, no, this section does not permit large-scale projects which include multiple wind and or solar systems designed to produce energy for wholesale purposes.
Yeah.
Okay. Retail.
There's also some other language that's,
retail's okay.
under C, B, shadow flicker, the tower shall be located so as to reduce the occurrence of shadow flicker. That's sort of an ambiguous term, reduce it. That's a relative term. Do we say eliminate the occurrence of shadow flicker on inhabited structures located on adjacent properties? Food for thought. Can we say that? Because you're standing in your kitchen and you're getting that fluorescent bulb thing going on with shadow flicker. So that's something to think about. Same thing on item F under C, signal interference. The owner or operator shall make reasonable efforts to avoid any disruption. I say the owner or operator shall eliminate any disruption or loss of radio, telephone, etc., and mitigate harm caused by the system. And I would say that needs to refer to the adjacent properties.
Yeah, because you're going to know how horrible that would be if you never put in a wind turbine and you lost internet.
Or your neighbor lost internet. That's, I think, what they're trying to say there. And then some of this, they get like under height, tower height 2A, talks about commercial. What about residential? And then later on, and this is just as you're looking at it, Chandler, under 3, rooftop mounted wind energy systems, it talks about R1 zones. And I know you haven't gotten into all this. It's just from them. But what about commercial? So we get some development proposal for a commercial district.
Well, is that something you guys know we've gone the rounds in our commercial area. And I feel like the city's tried to hold ourselves to a really high standard. Do we want to see a wind turbine down there? I would say that that's probably something that it should just be outright prohibited based on the discussions we've had for the last year and a half. And I think Council Member Zapala can probably weigh in on that. I don't know what your thoughts are. Can you make a colonial-style wind turbine?
I think it depends on what the cost of electricity is in 10 years from now. We'll determine that, what our attitude is.
Can we revisit this? What are your thoughts?
You're talking about specifically in the commercial zone?
Yeah. That's the
answer. Not sure. Really what I'm trying to say is just let's make sure we've got all of our zoning covered. And what we're doing here. That's really all I'm trying to say. Some of the sections refer to residential, and then we're left to assume for commercial and vice versa.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure we're comprehensive. And
okay. I think that's a good point.
What we're covering. Yeah, I mean,
I'm thinking less wind turbines that are colonial and more the situation where Walmart decides they're going to put solar panels on their whole roof.
If we made it,
which is a great idea until you live up above Walmart and it. The reflections shine into your windows, right?
But this is a problem. Let's say when Garbett Homes bought their lots down at Bridgestone, they were selling them as solar lots. And one of the concerns we had was, well, what's this going to do for people on Canyon Heights during a sunset or something? Is this going to reflect off and bounce it to them? This was a concern for us. So it's not just Walmart, though. It's this whole lower end of the city affecting the higher end on a reflection. So, but Walmart would be the big offender if they
do get all the snow plowing services, so maybe this is revenge.
It all balances out, right?
Any further discussion on this item before we move on?
Okay.
Let's move on to item number 6, discussion on allowing short-term rentals and Airbnbs.
So as your memo stated, the city has 2 listings for Airbnbs within the city. We do have one that I guess I was speaking with our code enforcement officer yesterday that we do get a few complaints on. And some of the complaints are valid, some are not. The list of the complaints was everything from, as neighbors, we don't know who those people are.
Yeah.
That's not something I can regulate. But things like parking, noise, trash, those are things where the city can step in and say, hold on, we may have a nuisance here. Now, some cities, and cities, I didn't provide any code because cities are all over the board on this one. There are some that have gone so far as to say we don't want any. Cities like St. George, I believe, are on the end of we don't want these, which is striking because they're a tourism city and this is something that would really help them. Cities like Hurricane have allowed it, but with certain exemptions that like the owner must be present. It must be an owner-occupied dwelling. So the Airbnb works. You can rent a couch, you can rent a room, or you can rent the house. So Hurricane said, okay, well, you can rent a couch and you can rent a room, but the owner needs to be in the house at the time. And that's to mitigate some of these negative impacts. The 2 that the city has that I'm aware of are not owner-occupied. And we would currently we'd probably just treat them like a rental business license. But how they affect the neighborhood is a little bit different, if you can imagine. Somebody that's going to be there for one night is probably going to act differently than somebody that's going to be there for a year. So this is where the problem is. And I don't have any recommendations other than I think we just need to make sure we address it and have answers when people call and ask. I can see merit in a lot of different things. So I would appreciate your input on this. If you have something to say.
I just wanted to react to your comments that you just said it. You said, well, maybe somebody who's going to be there a long time, a year, is going to take better care of the house than someone's there for a day. I've actually found it to be completely opposite. I've rented Airbnbs quite a bit.
Have you?
When you rent an Airbnb, because it's short-term, the owner is going to make sure that the place looks really, really nice and is well kept up, because no one wants to rent a really junky place for a vacation that they're paying extra for. Whereas when we
I was referring more to when they leave the house or when they're at the house, not the appearance of the house when they walk in.
But you're charged for that extra if you trash it, so they have a way to crack down on that. Whereas for longer-term rental, that's when somebody's like, well, this isn't my house. You know, they're going to let the yard go because they're not going to invest a lot of time and effort in making the yard look nice. And the owner who's renting it is generally not there for a long time. And so I've actually had much worse experiences with longer-term rentals than with short-term.
That's good input. But to your point, though, most of the complaints we get in the city on nuisance complaints are from renters, long-term renters, not short-term renters.
The deposit you pay, at least the ones we've done, it's compared to what you're paying for the place. It's a pretty significant deposit.
Have you done an Airbnb before?
We stayed in D.C. for a week. We rented a house in D.C. and stayed there. It was great. I mean, it was an awesome
idea. Did you trash it?
So, no, we didn't trash it because we had paid like $500 deposit for the week, for 1 week.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. And you want to get that balance.
Yeah, you want your deposit.
Yeah. So I have a couple of thoughts. Outright, I think that we should wait and not do anything on this for a couple of reasons. My understanding, speaking with some people, is one, that the league is looking into this, doing some research. Two is that there's going to be legislation presented this next session by Representative Notwell from Harriman. I don't know exactly what's in it, but some of these cities, I think, are trying to treat it as a land use issue when it's not a land use issue, because it's the only difference between an aunt or somebody or a friend coming and staying for a week is an exchange of some money. And the land is not being used any differently. But now where the city could step in is through the nuisances, where noise pollution or parking issues or trash or something like that, but that's not land use. And especially where we only have two listings and it's not pressing, we're in a position where we can kind of just see what happens over the next year with the legislation and any research that's being done by the league. I don't think we're even at a point where we have to do that. Those complaints can be addressed specifically to noise or parking. That's my suggestion, is that we wait for a while.
Are you getting complaints already?
We've had a few, but I wouldn't say that it's an exorbitant amount.
But I mean, why? Is this a rental that has the business license that is required?
To my knowledge, they do.
So you know who the owner, so you know who to talk
to. But I mean, I don't know that the percentage of complaints is any higher than the percentage of complaints we get from just renters in general.
But I'm just saying, at least in this case, these two cases,
we know who to talk to.
If they're a problem.
Yeah.
I think that's the key thing. That was the key thing about getting business licenses for rentals, was so we knew who to talk to when there was a
problem. That was, yeah. And actually, that's been a really good thing. I think we've seen a real decrease in the amount of complaints we've had based on that code. And our code enforcement officer actually does a really, really good job of going after people and making sure that they're in compliance. She's a bulldog. She's awesome.
Okay. So that's good to know.
Going after owners of rental property.
Well, I mean, if you have a house and you don't do your front yard, you don't maintain your front yard, and your neighbors complain, well, she'll let you know. She'll issue violations, and then if the fines, we have a system of fining them. Yeah. She'll make corrections. She's been really good for the city.
Sure. I'll share my thoughts on this. I have a strong feeling in opposition to allowing short-term rentals and Airbnbs in our city altogether. It's based on some personal experience. I'm maybe a little biased, but when I bought my home at Cedar Hills, one of the things that attracted me to Cedar Hills was that at the time it was zoned a single family dwelling, and I was buying into a neighborhood that I thought was single family dwelling. Of course, subsequently, a few years later, the code has changed. Now there's a lot more renters going on, and I think that it's easy to dismiss the "I don't know who my neighbors are" comment because it's not codifying. It's not really something you can really do, but it's a legitimate concern, I think, on the part of residents. I know I live next to a lady who had a four-bedroom house and rented each bedroom out. So there were five cars instead of one. People came and went. Strangers standing in my front yard. I don't know why. People coming to my house thinking it's their house because they got the wrong address. At all sorts of times of day. It's just generally, I think it, I guess maybe old fashioned, I'm living in a Mayberry delusion. But I don't see a strong reason to turn our residential zone into essentially a commercial zone for hotels, really. That's what we're talking about is miniature hotels or motels, right? I mean, a person has 5-6 bedrooms,
hey,
put a bunk bed in there and rent out, you know, run out to as many people as you can, right? Especially if Snowbird gets their way at the canyon, and now we have tourists coming here that want to spend the weekend, go skiing at the canyon. I think that, anyway, I'm just strongly opposed to it. That's just where I stand on the topic.
So I appreciate that, and I'm wondering, does that mean you would want to limit regular rentals as well?
I've been opposed to that as well, but...
I don't know that we legally can, like, limit people from renting a home. I really wonder if that's even something we can do. Like if I own
a home. I remember years ago, and this was back when I was on the Planning Commission, we had a long, long discussion about what a family was.
Oh, right. We still have that discussion. That's still not settled.
Right. I remember that, too. We talked about that.
And how many people could live in a home that were unrelated and so forth. And that, you know, that was
and
how
to be quite honest, I think our family code is wrong. I think it needs to change. And I just don't know what the right answer is. But I would have real hesitations passing code saying you can't rent out your house. I really question the legality of that. Brian, and you're a lawyer. I'm
just thinking about the only difference between these situations that we're trying to regulate is when there's a monetary transaction, because you can invite somebody to come and use your home or stay your home or whether you're there or you're not, you know, kids have sleepovers, you know, or whatever. I mean, and just by that monetary transaction, now you're, you know, creating a violation, and I don't know if it's something that will rise up to like a criminal violation or anything like that. But with stuff going on with you know, where people are working on this at the state level and on a broader level, I think yeah. Because we only have two listings, we're in a fine position to sit and wait and see what they come up with with the league and the legislature.
If the state is going to act, then, and that's news to me, so I'm glad you brought that up. If the state's going to act, then we're going to be subject to anything they enact. So, I don't know. I don't want to get with the cart ahead of the horse here.
You can't necessarily regulate, you know, who comes and goes, but you can regulate the commerce aspect of it, right? It is a business. They're charging for it. You have to have business license and meet certain rules to run a business. So that part could be regulated.
And it is.
And it is, but, you know, could be more strongly regulated if there was an issue or something.
The only thing that's not regulated is the duration. And that's really what it comes down to. If somebody signs a rental agreement, it's typically for 6 months to a year at a minimum. The purpose of Airbnb is I need somewhere to stay for a night, for two nights. So that's the difference. One of the issues that major metropolitan areas are seeing, and I know this does not affect us, but places like San Francisco, there's a lot of examples given where people were renting out their houses or their units for $2,500 a month, and then they kicked out the people that were renting so that they could make it an Airbnb where they would charge $500 a night. So it had a real negative impact on affordable housing in the area, because now all of a sudden all the affordable housing was being used as Airbnb. So that's not something that I think affects the city here. So the commerce aspect of it,
and
I don't know.
And I'm a hypocrite, by the way. So last week, I rented a beach house in Oregon for a week. Okay? I don't really have a problem with this concept in a tourist, kind of a known tourist destination, if you will. But bedroom community, predominantly single-family dwelling homes, I just not in favor of that.
Okay.
But what these tourist communities used to be, bedroom communities... Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's an evolution that takes place.
I think that goes to more of a reason not to regulate it at this point, just because it's not a tourist place, so we don't have that much of it.
Well, to your point earlier, I wonder, because we talked about this with the city council, and they asked for us to go back to the planning commission. But I really wonder how much of a land use issue this is. This seems more like, if you open the city code, it seems more like a Title III issue where it deals with residential business licensing.
Yeah. This is about as far away from single family dwelling you can get, right? You can now.
Well, I mean, I think you're assuming the worst case scenario. Somebody's got six rooms and they're going to rent it out to six different people each night, every night, and that's I think
it's like
that's
a hostel versus.
Yeah,
but that's what this permits, though, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about.
Not necessarily.
Right? We're talking about throwing it into Title III and then regulating it and saying, you know, how many people and.
Yeah. So that way when we see listings that would advertise for something like, I have six bedrooms and I'd love to rent it to six families, we can contact that owner and say, not so fast. Because usually with these, they have to advertise for them, so it's not too hard to follow what they're advertising for.
So I just wanted to add, if you're thinking about restricting short-term rentals altogether, then Provo's code does a good job of doing this. They obviously deal a lot with rentals, and so they've tightened up their rental code over the number of years.
Well, and Provo is a destination where people want to come in for a weekend for a football game.
Yeah.
Well, they have a draw that I don't know that Cedar Hills necessarily has.
Well, I guess they probably say Cedar Hills and Redwood.
Just in my opinion, I agree with David. Yeah. Almost everything he said. We've been very disappointed. We bought into Cedar Hills as opposed to a number of other communities because of the lack of rentals, and we've been very disappointed with how much there is and the condition of the properties that we see. So I would be more in favor of moving in the direction. If Provo has greater restrictions on this type of dwelling, I'd sure like to look into it and see. You know, I don't want to over-regulate our community, but there could be, you know, this could grow. It's been disappointing and even sometimes a little shocking as to how much of that is going on here in this bedroom community that we really thought we were buying into a much stronger single family home community. And you know, I'm repeating myself now, but it's been disappointing. I don't mind waiting because I think that's I think we should do some research, but I think that's some good counsel. And if the state's going to do something, if the legislature is looking into this issue, I'd be interested to see what direction they're going. But just for the record, I'm inclined to lean in the direction that David outlined.
Okay.
Are these typically, like, I got the impression from the people we rented from in D.C. that they owned multiple properties that they rented. It was like a business for them.
I don't know that that's the case here.
But I mean, I don't know that.
I don't know that I'm at all interested
in.
I know in one case it's not.
Kind of, I mean, if that's where we end up heading, I'd be concerned too.
And you said St. George has regulated this, and
I believe it was St. George that passed the law.
Can we look at that?
Yeah, we can look at St. George. Theirs might have been more financially driven, just because when you stay in a hotel, you pay a hotel tax.
That was the hotel lobby behind there.
Yeah. And when you stay in an Airbnb, I don't know that you necessarily pay that same hotel tax. So St. George said we're missing out on some money here.
And then our hotel business
isn't that great.
I'm a hypocrite, right? I want this activity in certain places, not others. I mean, if I was to buy a beach house in Oregon myself personally, I would probably rent it out almost every week of the year except for the week I wanted to go, right? If I was wealthy enough to own a home someplace else, I would rent it out and then I'd go there when I wanted. But just an anecdotal story. So I own some property up in Heber Valley, and it's a homeowners association, and they restrict Airbnbs if they're all together in short-term rentals. And I don't have the data behind their reasoning, but my understanding is because they concluded that it increased the crime
in that community.
I don't
have the evidence. I'm just saying that's why they opted to go that direction. So
I don't know. I'm thinking, you know, as a from the homeowner perspective, not the neighbor perspective, but if I have a property that I'm not or a home that I'm not occupying, and I'm trying to rent it out long term, do my 6 or 12 month cycle, you know, and it's vacant for a while, I'd want to throw it up on Airbnb and see if I can at least cover some of the mortgage for that 2 or 3 months that it's vacant, or however long it is. But yeah. I mean, that's just obviously one scenario.
So there's a couple of reasons why we want to look at maybe regulating this. Is the crime and the, it's not like it's going to cost any tax revenue, but these other things. So when we look at other cities that have brought in that thing that you want to bring to us, and we talk about this, is like this for these reasons, an outline, this for this reason.
Yeah.
Outline.
We can do that.
We've kind of talked about taxes and hotel taxes and that kind of thing. Would we tax Airbnb stays, like, as a business?
No, tax? I don't even know how we'd go about that. They would have to, if there was any sort of commercial tax exchanged, there would be almost like a food truck route where the food trucks come in, they pin their location of the sales that night, and they share their taxes with Utah State Tax, and then they remit their taxes back to the cities. It would have to be something like that, where they're paying the taxes directly to the state, where I don't know that the city would at any point really know that they're paying their taxes or not.
Walmart works too, though?
Walmart goes directly to the state and comes back to us. Because it's split between, there's a certain portion that stays at point of sale, and then there's a certain portion that's gone to the state pool that gets divided out amongst the cities based on population. So that we just get the final check every month. Okay. I think there's some good direction
Any more discussion? So item number 7, discussion on violations for non-compliance with terms of conditional use permits. I asked for this to be on the agenda, just full disclosure, would be a good discussion item. I don't know, Chandler, you wanted to present anything on this or not?
You asked for it, I believe it was back in June that we've looked at this. The city adopted their current conditional use permit code, which is found in 10.537 of the city code. And part of it is the revocation upon non-compliance. So if something happens on the property, and what we've got is complaints, the revocation comes in when the conditional use permit was obtained in a fraudulent manner. The use for which the conditional use permit was granted has now ceased for at least 6 months. Consecutive months, and one or more of the conditions of the conditional use permit have not been substantially met. And there's other ways that you can, other clauses that you can, conditions that you can add for revocation. Things that I saw were the holder failed to comply with the conditions, the holder has failed to maintain the site, operation of the site has been determined to be a nuisance, and then the use was obtained by fraudulent or misrepresentation at the time. What I found, though, was that we would be breaking ground as far as if the discussion that Dave and I had was based on financial penalties for people that had failed to meet the terms of their conditional use permits. And what I found is that the city would be blazing new trails here as far as being, I think we would be the only ones that financially penalize somebody that didn't meet the terms of their conditional use permit. I looked at about 20 other cities, and I couldn't find a single one that did financial penalties. I looked at Lehigh, Draper, Harriman, Pleasant Grove, Mapleton, Nephi, South Jordan, Clearfield, Hurricane, Beaver, Holiday, Springdale. They all have no financial penalties, but they have revocation clauses. Some go as far as having annual reviews of all conditional use permits, which made me think, okay, is it even legal to have financial penalties? And we asked our attorney. They said it is, but they don't recommend it. Now, the reason they don't recommend it is because you're basically letting somebody pay to be a nuisance. So if you're found, if you're finding that they got their CUP based on a fraudulent manner, or the CUP is a nuisance and we're receiving complaints, as long as they pay their fine, they can continue to operate in that manner. So those were the thoughts of staff. This is something we looked into, I think it was like 2 months ago.
Yeah.
It was an interesting discussion. It was definitely an interesting exercise.
So look, let me share my thoughts.
Yes, please.
So my concern with the code is there's nothing in between granting and revocating. And for example, this all kind of came up with the Walmart, right? The yard stuff out on the parking lot, right? Mm-hmm. Is anybody in the city really going to revoke Walmart's conditional use permit to exist as a store? No, I don't think so, right? And they know that too, right? So they'll just thumb their nose and do what they want to do. And so my thought process was that if there was something in between, you know, the granting of and revocating, there was, whether it was the city had the option to either revocate or charge a fee. And it's not either or, right? It's not like you...
It would have to be a or.
Why would it be an or?
I don't know how you can revoke and fine.
Well, I'm just saying, if you, the city could opt to either fine them and even eventually revoke them, even after fining them.
Oh, I was thinking it was revocation and or. I don't know if you could do both.
I'm saying that if you decided to, you wanted to fine them, you fine them a fee for 12 months, and it's just not nothing. That's not the, no results are occurring, right?
Yeah.
They're making enough money off garden supplies that the $10 a month or whatever the fee is, right? It's just pay the fee, right? You can still move to revocation. But my concern was that there's no tool or mechanism or influence to control or influence behavior other than revocating. And I just don't see that happening in some cases. So that's why
that's an interesting point. In the case of Walmart, they actually were really easy to work with once they put all that stuff out. We did get a couple of complaints from former council members that were on the council at the time that clause in their development agreement that they couldn't have outdoor sales was put in place. And I remember going down to Walmart and meeting with them on a few occasions and drafting up a plan. And once they came to the city council, I mean, it was taken care of pretty shortly thereafter. So Walmart was actually fairly easy to work with once they realized that they were in non-compliance. They were good tenants. They're good to work with.
They just because they never actually met their conditional use, though. They just kind of chilled it back a little bit, right? They continued to sell things outside.
But they're based on their conditional use. They were allowed to sell things outside because they came to the city and we showed them certain areas where the city council then said, okay, you can sell in these areas.
Okay.
So, one of the issues the city council had was that they were blocking certain portions of their parking lot.
But they could have elected not to be a good player, right? They could have said, I think we'll just do what we're going to do.
They could have.
I mean,
you're right.
And under that scenario, is anybody really going to revoke Walmart?
But let's talk about, so you're saying the city needs teeth. Let's talk about it, because this is the issue with, Jeff brought up a lot of problems with rentals. This is the exact same problem we have with rentals, in that somebody comes, they get a rental business license, and then they trash their yard, or they don't maintain their yard, or they have broken windows, they have parking violations.
Sure.
What power does the city have? I can't issue a ticket. What power does the city have to issue a fine? What power do we have to make correction? We struggled with this. We grappled with this for quite some time. What we do now is there's a zoning violation on your utility bill. If you get a zoning violation, you get fined. So let's say that Jeff is an avid water user and has the third watering violation. He gets a $200 fine. That would be added to his utility bill. But with Walmart, once again, it's almost like you're letting them pay to violate that. And I think that there's other methods. I think that there's ways to work with Walmart other than financial penalties.
Can't you just increase the fine over time? Even if it goes up exponentially over time, even Walmart can get hurt.
Even Walmart could get hurt, but I think I just think that there's a better way to do this. Sorry.
So to that point, even Walmart could get hurt. Even Walmart could pack up and leave, and then we'd have an empty big box that nobody would want.
Yeah.
That's not the circumstance that you want.
This is kind of my point, is I think that where we were asking Walmart to be good neighbors, I think we also need to be aware of some of the challenges that they face. And in their store down there, they've mentioned that in spring they have a high demand for certain products that they cannot store inside the store, and they don't have the room for it. And they get, from their regional office, they get pallets and pallets of flowers and pavers and soil and sod, and they can't bring that into the store, but there's a demand for it here. So there's a weird dichotomy here of we want Walmart to provide these goods because it's the most convenient place to shop, but at the same time we want them to almost not provide these goods because we don't want them outside. It's a weird dichotomy.
I would say they brought us a store they intended to build and have here, right?
And say it again.
They came here with and applied to have a store.
Well, we beat them into that store. It was a lot different store.
The point is they opted to build the building they have, right? And they opted to accept the conditions that were granted unto them.
Yeah.
So now they want to change the business model.
Well, no.
Carry sod or carry things that don't allow them to meet the conditional use just so they can make more money, right?
But to provide something that is in demand, I mean, in our community. So, I mean, I don't see why we can't work with them. I mean, I think they need to look at what we're looking for, and we need to, I mean, I think both sides have to be flexible. I mean, that's the whole point of...
I also have real hesitation anytime our city could be the first to do something. I don't know. But sometimes on these things, it's not great to lead out.
I don't mind being out front. That doesn't bother me. And I'm raising it Walmart as an example, but you had examples of your own, Chandler, right? I mean, you have examples of how you're powerless to do something.
No, but we found other ways to help us get the desired result. Because ultimately, in the case of zoning violations, it's a nuisance and we get complaints. Whether it's working with AFPD on parking tickets or whether it's issuing a zoning violation through their utility bill, because if they decide that they're not going to pay their utility bill, if your balance gets high enough, your water gets shut off. And then things start to happen at that point.
I thought it was worthy of discussion because it seems like
I think it's worthy of discussion. Absolutely,
we're basically subject to the whims of the property owner as to whether or not they're willing to work with us, essentially, for any conditional use we issue.
And then there's also with Walmart, if it is really that bad, I mean, there's the option of withholding a business license until they're in compliance. I mean, there's other methods. I mean, we can be creative.
What other types of administrative sanctions have you seen for somebody that's not compliant aside from revocation?
None. It's either comply with the conditions of the conditional use permit, because the point of a conditional use permit, and I may be just preaching to the choir here, but it's that there's a unique set of circumstances attached to this project or this property or this proposal that there needs to be certain conditions in place for this to happen. For example, the deck on, remind me of that place, Beacon Heights, this assisted living center. There's a deck there, and we granted them a conditional use permit 2 years ago, maybe, where there's a unique set of circumstances with that deck that the city felt that could be workable, and we don't get complaints on it. There's no need to revoke it. But with Walmart, it's a unique circumstance because it's something that's going to come up every spring. Every spring they're going to want to come in and sell stuff, and they're going to want to sell it outside, and they're going to want to have lots of stuff because, believe it or not, lots of people want to go down there and buy lots of stuff. Lots of things, and that's just the case. And a lot of people are really happy with that, and some people don't like that it's out there. So, I don't know, as a city, we try to work with Walmart, and I think this next year what we're going to do is go down there in about February and try to work out a plan and get a conditional use permit and get a plan of action in place prior to the spring season coming.
On a slightly different example and topic, so when Dollar Tree was approved, there were three conditions placed on Dollar Tree. But doors on the garbage.
Which was already in the approved plan.
Right. And they did that. And then there was the no parking designation on the west side of the building, which they've done. And the third one was there's exposed wiring on the east side of the building. What is it? It's take care of it, right? That's still not taken care of. I don't know what it is. I hope it's safe. I don't know why it is. But
to that point, in order to pass a condition upon a, how do I word this? In order to place a condition on a conditional use permit, that has to meet a certain standard. What's the standard for an exposed wire? Is it safety? I mean, because right now it's sure. Just, I think it's just exposed conduit.
Well, I don't know what it is.
No one's... That's what they told me is it was just exposed conduit.
And
there's no safety. There's no nuisance. There's nothing. So, I mean, I think if the city were to say, we're going to revoke your business license, we're going to revoke your conditional use permit to operate in the SC1 zone, and they challenged us, I think that the courts would say, well, what's the standard for this condition?
Right. I think that,
and I don't think that there is one for that.
The condition was placed because of the concern for safety, because nobody in this body knew what that wire was.
Well, now that they do, then it becomes a non-issue.
I feel better about it. I mean, I've been sitting here wondering, you know.
It's just conduit, I believe.
Concerned citizen here.
It's just
but I don't know. To me, it seems like working with people is always easier than...
Yeah.
Well, I do agree with that, I'm not opposed to that. But we're still...
Just say, hey, either you work with us or you lose your... or we revoke your permit.
Yeah, sometimes, I guess, to the point earlier, that cities sometimes have gone as far to do to make things like this Class B or Class C misdemeanor on the property. Because at that point it becomes a nuisance, and then where the nuisance isn't corrected, then it becomes a Class B or Class C misdemeanor.
One thing I'll note is that Provo has a process for suspension, so you can get suspended or revoked. Mm-hmm. And there's a hearing that you have to go to.
So, I mean, there's something before any revocation or any financial penalties could be put in place.
And there's certain conditions where they'll revoke it right away if it meets certain conditions where it's hazardous to continue, for example. But if it's not hazardous, they'll give you 3 days' notice and hold a hearing.
So maybe that's the way we go, is that they...
That's really interesting. That's an interesting intermediary.
Yeah, it
opportunity
is.
To get together and talk
it
about
is. It. Beaver, I believe, is the one that does an annual review of their CUPs, going around looking at them, making sure that they still are all in compliance. That seems very... time intensive.
I think it would have to be
planning commission members would have to do the annual review.
Yeah, you all get like a list.
How many open CUPs do we have?
I think
hundreds. It's hundreds, and some of them are already. If you look at the, I don't have the list of what everything is a CUP in the city, but all the commercial businesses, every home occupation business, every business rental is a CUP, is granted by CUP. And those are all, believe it or not, annually reviewed. When it comes time for their business license, our code enforcement officer goes and inspects every single business license. She walks through every single home.
Depending on what kind of business.
If it's a business that people enter into, she goes into it. So if a salon or daycare, she'll go into it. Or a dance studio, she'll go into it and make sure that it meets all the standards. And believe it or not, people year after year fail for the same reason. They didn't put a fire extinguisher out, you know, so she makes them do that. So there is an annual review for some of these things. Some of them don't need an annual review. Things like the Beacon Heights deck. I don't need to go down there every year to go look at their deck. Odds are it's not going to change that much. And if it does change drastically, we're going to hear about it. Or whether it's through a building permit or a complaint. So I don't know that an annual review for all CUPs is the way to go. But, I mean, there's probably methods that the city could enact that would ensure compliance or future compliance, I should say.
Well, I would, you know, we might beat it at a horse here. I just thought it'd be worthy of discussion. I still think it's worth exploring something between
granting and revocating. I do agree that working with the owner is, you know, step one is preferred, right? But if there's somebody who's belligerent and says, no, you know, revocate me, you know, and depending on what the circumstances, I mean, no one's really going to revocate Walmart. Just close that store down, right?
Over. Yeah, but they're not going to take it to that point either because they can't handle the, I mean, they have to live with the city. I mean, they have to work with us. I mean, they live here.
They don't have to work with us.
They don't have to, but
right.
They do. They do have to in a practical sense.
The store's probably already paid for. They can walk away. It wasn't beneficial for them.
But generally speaking, that and maybe I'm just being stringent, but
I've never dealt with it. I don't know. I mean, I deal with clients all the time, and you know, they'd rather deal with you than fight with you.
I'm just an individual that believes when you make an agreement with organization that you should fulfill that unless otherwise arranged, right? I mean, even the small wire by Dollar Tree, right? Just a small thing, but you know, they agreed to do that, but they haven't done it. You know, it's just in my mind, I just like to see, maybe I'm just trying to dot all the I's and cross the T's, but I think when we don't enforce or ignore some small things, that those can create an attitude of leading to bigger things. It's a simple thing for them to fix, right?
Yeah.
So why?
Well, it could be. I actually don't even know exactly how it works.
I mean, it's probably conduit for like running for your sprinkler system. I mean, something that is yet to be.
I believe what they said it was telecommunications conduit. So.
I mean, just put a cap on it.
That's easy. But one other item of housekeeping. If this body were to say, yeah, we really want to see financial penalties, it's not this body that enacts financial penalties. It would be the City Council making an amendment to the fee schedule, yeah. Just as a matter of note.
All right, is there any other discussion on number 7? If not, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
I'll
second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? All right.